have the pleasure of bringing on Jack Crawford. He is Impact Ventures, but he's also a good friend. And I was trying to think, Jack, the first time we met, I think it was as I was being introduced to the Entrepreneurs Organization. And we had some common ground, but I was sort of new to this Sacramento entrepreneurial community. And you were one of those people that is a pillar in the community and was then as well. So thanks for coming on and sharing your story a little bit and having a conversation about what's going on in your life, what's going in our lives together, because we're working on a lot of the same stuff.
Oh, it's always great to be with you, Mark.
Yeah. So thinking about that, Jack, so I had sold my companies. I joined the Entrepreneurs Organization, and I had recently written a mission statement about creating opportunity for my family, for my friends, and for my community, this hometown that that raised me in so many ways. But like you and I were talking earlier, my focus was really around the country. I had this video security company that did only 1% of our business here in Sacramento, yet I was raised here. This is my hometown, and you know, we want to, I think as we get older in these next chapters in our life, we want to maybe focus on a way to build a legacy. And for me, it's like, okay, what can I do to help my hometown? I saw what you were doing, and I was sort of amazed at this entrepreneurial ecosystem that was emerging here in Sacramento. So, I mean, give me your sense as to where we're at today and, you know, how you got excited about that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think what I see is a pattern of individual entrepreneurs having success here in particular industry sectors, and recognizing that maybe while they were building their businesses across the country like you did, maybe their backyard wasn't overly relevant. There wasn't a lot of customers. You know, there wasn't a lot of interaction with their community. Then they get to, you know, a certain level of success, either a highly profitable business or a significant exit, and they start thinking more about legacy. They start thinking more about purpose. They start, you know, sort of looking back into, you know, what's happening in Sacramento. And I think if we look at kind of just over the last 5-10 years as you and I have been collaborating more actively, Sacramento is doing a great job of, at least from the tech sector standpoint, connecting itself with the Silicon Valley.
Okay.
So instead of just sort of thinking about Sacramento as an entrepreneurial ecosystem, I think more and more people are thinking about sort of Northern California. What's happening in Northern California? And how can we make what's happening here relevant to what's happening in Silicon Valley or what's happening statewide or, candidly, what's happening across the country and around the world, and what businesses can be created here and sort of scaled up statewide or across the country. So it's been interesting.
Interesting. So yeah, right down the street, we've got San Francisco, Silicon Valley. Now you sort of consider that part of this mega region instead of Sacramento standing on its own. But I think, are you alone in those thoughts, or is that, would you consider that the consensus? Because guys like me are sort of like, oh, I care about my hometown. And I don't get out to the Bay Area as much today, unless I'm going to a Niner game or something, or a Giants game.
There are thousands of people that are going back and forth between Sacramento and the Bay Area, and so we kind of introduced this idea of a technology triangle between Sacramento, San Francisco, and San Jose. And we started to look at the activity inside that region, the number of companies funded, the new entrepreneurs launching new businesses, and I think the key for us was sort of looking at it, how is Sacramento relevant to what's happening in the Silicon Valley, and now there's major areas of innovation that are being influenced by policy. And so if you look at driverless vehicles, we have to figure out citizen safety. If you look at drones, we have to figure out things around airspace, and that's going to be influenced by policy. So the policy expertise in Sacramento is becoming more and more relevant to the areas of innovation that Silicon Valley is sort of leading the way on. And now you have local entrepreneurs that are starting to think about those areas of innovation, and that's creating the rise up of an entrepreneurial community here. And so, you know, nothing's ever going to compare with the Silicon Valley, but if you look at regions like Denver, Boulder, Seattle, San Diego, that get about 2-4% of the U.S.'s venture capital invested into it, Sacramento is starting to kind of rise up a bit and be included in sort of what's happening in the Bay Area. And I think that if we look inside that triangle and we think about the companies that will will be built, I think Sacramento has a role to play. And so candidly, as a big fan of the Sacramento ecosystem, I realized something just over the last 3 or 4 years. And that's that after sort of trumpeting my enthusiasm for the entrepreneurial community here in Sacramento for a decade, I realized that there are hundreds of other cities across the country that are doing the same thing, saying, hey, we're just about to create this great tech company or this vibrant entrepreneurial ecosystem. But so in that case, Sacramento wasn't differentiated. But as soon as we started to amplify the importance of access and an understanding of policy influence over major areas of innovation, we're sitting here in California's capital. Right. Suddenly, we become relevant statewide, nationwide, because the policy influence over technology that's set in California is oftentimes adopted across the country. Right. And so we have this unique expertise. So this isn't, I'm not talking about us as a government town and sort of selling and buying things from the government as a customer. That is an opportunity. I'm talking about major areas of policy that will shape the companies in particular industry sectors, cryptocurrency, drones, digital health. These areas are really interesting.
I can see that these policies are shaped here right down the street at the Capitol in many ways. But from an entrepreneurial standpoint, it's cool to be around that. But yeah, what I'm thinking is, if I'm an entrepreneur, How do I tap into that at all? Who are the people that really want to be here? You mentioned driverless cars and drones and things like that. So are you seeing companies that want to be here because of policy, and they're actually moving their businesses here or launching their businesses here?
I think they're just paying attention. I think from the standpoint of mobilizing an entrepreneurial community, they're probably going to move here for customers, for talent, yeah, for things like operational efficiencies, you know, those types of things. Getting access to policymakers is something more that we're trumpeting as part of the large summit that we're running, this Impact Global Venture Summit later right. this month. But that's where we're bringing together market insight from policymakers, from market leaders in corporations, and market innovators in startups. And so where they end up locating is kind of an interesting question, because we have 10 portfolio companies that we have added to the fund. So we've made investments from $250,000 to $3 million into 10 different companies. Six of those companies have ties to Sacramento.
Okay.
Some of them are located here. You know, Pondera, a cybersecurity company focused on the government sector. Advanced Farm, you may know it. It's a robotics company mm-hmm. that's focused on fruit picking in Davis. There's a number of them that are actually located here. But there's some that have a presence here, and then a presence in Denver, a presence here, and a presence in Austin, a presence here, executives and founders that are here, but their development team and largest office is in the Bay Area. So the next generation entrepreneurial community and the companies that are being built will be headquartered in a very different way, at least as it relates to the tech sector, the sector that I'm operating in, yeah, right? These virtual teams, so the talent can be anywhere, and these companies are starting to scale up and recognizing that maybe we need 3 or 4 offices, and one of them, you know, might be in Sacramento to tap into, you know, the talent base here, or mm-hmm. sometimes the founders are here.
What do you think is missing from our ecosystem here in Sacramento? Right? I hear people use the term collaboration, and it seems like there's people that are working not so side by side at times, and there's times when we do collaborate. But I mean, other people talk about things that might be missing. Some people might even say there's not a lot of money in Sacramento. I mean, what's your take on that?
Well, I mean, I think we're clearly doing a better job of getting coordinated as an ecosystem. The Greater Sacramento Economic Council is doing some really interesting things. Mark, you've been an incredible promotional platform for the entrepreneurial community here. The leadership role you played with EO, some of the other things that you're doing, I think is sort of, you know, they're elevating the entrepreneurial ecosystem here, which is great. I think the missing elements include things like capital. And so capital formation in some of the undercapitalized geographies, particularly in California, is one of the other elements that we'll talk about actually at the summit. Lenny mm-hmm. Mendonca, who is the chief economic and business advisor for the governor, has a statewide view on how regions can rise together. And it's looking at the regions outside of Silicon Valley and saying, how can these kind of robust entrepreneurial communities get access to more capital? Because right now, I think it's 48% of all venture capital is invested into Northern California, with a huge concentration right in the Silicon Valley, right?
Yes.
So it's significant more. So how can we get access? How can we give entrepreneurs in those underdeveloped entrepreneurial communities access to capital. And there's a couple of answers out there. Corporate venture is starting to get really active. So, you know, most people are familiar with Intel Capital and Google Ventures, but now there's hundreds of corporate venture groups, many of which are coming to our summit. And they'll invest anywhere. They're not necessarily concentrated on Silicon Valley. So to answer your question, I think capital formation in undercapitalized regions like Sacramento, throughout the state of California, throughout the country, really a real focus on capital formation is one of the keys.
You know, it's interesting. I get a question. I want to kind of throw it at you, but I get this question. Mark, what do you do and why do you do it? They know that I have a podcast. They know we have this media platform. But what are you doing all this for, and what do you really do? And, you know, along the way, I've sort of discovered that we're building this platform that really provides access to capital, access to expertise, access to this community that we're building around entrepreneurship. And I think a lot of people don't feel like they tap into that access. But I've been doing this to start with because I think helping entrepreneurs in my hometown is good for my hometown. When an entrepreneur succeeds, it's good for the entire community. It's jobs and so on. So I won't call it completely philanthropic, but I would call it like I'm just trying to be a guy that does right by his community. Now it's kind of turning into a business, which is fun and I think differentiated. But then I look over here at Impact Venture Capital, right? You're a venture capital company, and you're also a person with partners in the Bay Area, but you're also a person that really cares about our community. So you're doing this big event, Impact Venture Summit at Golden One Arena, June 19th. It's a big deal. You've been doing it for a few years now. You got to get out there if you want to get exposed to a lot of information, but also a lot of people that are really motivated to help grow entrepreneurship. And so I think it's a fun thing. But I think to myself, look, this can't be a big profit center for you. You've got this huge undertaking that you do. It's around helping the community. And, you know, how do you justify that kind of effort when you're also trying to build a venture capital company simultaneously?
Yeah, let me make one comment on some of your activities and my view on your activities, and then I'll comment on the event and how I think it's relevant to what we're doing at Impact Venture Capital. So I think that when I look at, and you and I have developed a friendship and have collaborated on philanthropic activities, on professional activities, been part of the entrepreneurs organization, so we've done a lot of different things together, so I've got to see firsthand some of your activities. What I've been impressed with, candidly, is that as the rest of the world is playing chess or checkers, you're playing, you know, sort of 3D chess, right? You have this business that effectively you're running. You have a promotional platform with what you're doing with the radio show and some of the media activities. You have philanthropic activities. You have a kind of a state-of-the-art incubator here with your facility. All of those things help to take an idea through the entrepreneurial process and create value, right? And some of the people that you're interacting with also happen to have a broader perspective on life, let's say. Mm-hmm. And so they're thinking about building a valuable business. They're thinking about their community. They're thinking about a positive impact on the world. And so I think what I've been impressed with and what I've tried to learn from is effectively the leverage that you're getting on your time, because you're doing a lot of this stuff with family and friends and you're having success on multiple fronts. And so it's been fun to see. So anyway, congratulations
that.
On all the progress and continued success going
forward. Well, it's definitely been a learning opportunity, and I would throw it back to you as you answer your question. But you inspired me in many ways at the beginning of this by what you were already doing with venture capital and with helping train the up-and-comers. And I'm like, wow, if guys like Jack are doing this, what's my role in this ecosystem? So I've been sort of learning from you and trying to play my part. So thank you, though, for the compliments.
Sure. So, I mean, from an Impact Venture Capital standpoint, one of the things that we realized was, you know, if we're going to access the best entrepreneurs at the seed stage level, we need to do more than just provide capital. Oftentimes, we need to provide help to those companies before we actually invest. And so if you're building a venture fund, you're likely going to say no to 99% of the entrepreneurial community that you interact with. So how can you provide sort of capital for that 1%, the best companies that you identify, but value for the other 99%? Because some of them are going to end up turning into great companies, and you want to effectively know those companies, you want to know those entrepreneurs, and you want to support them along the way. Mm-hmm. Of course, in addition to our firm being headquartered in Burlingame and then having an investment office here in Sacramento, I, as a longtime sort of Sacramento business person, have a huge affinity for what's going on in my backyard. And so I've been trying to figure out ways to make Sacramento differentiated and relevant to investors, not only in Silicon Valley, but across the country. And I realized that if we could mobilize the right group of corporate venture groups, the right group of startups, and the right group of policymakers, we could actually do something quite unique here. Mm-hmm. And so it's not the Impact Global Venture Summit on June 19th at the Golden One Center is not an economic development event for Sacramento. But with that said, it's an incredible opportunity for Sacramento to get access to some very interesting people. So specifically, the president of Sprint is coming out from New York to be a keynote. As you may know, Sprint and T-Mobile are merging, $25 billion transaction. He's flying out to basically talk about what's happening in the telecommunication space, what's happening with the merger, what's happening. I think that's highly relevant to people statewide, not just in Sacramento. Lenny Mendonca is coming to talk about sort of policy initiatives around economic development, around business, what's happening statewide, how he is going to effectively have an influence on bringing capital to not only undercapitalized geographies throughout the state of California, but also undercapitalized segments of the entrepreneurial community, meaning women and minorities are not getting enough capital invested into their businesses, and he has ideas for how to shape that. He's got a particularly interesting point of view. There's a chief strategy officer that was at Adobe that has now launched something called Kickbox. He's presented to thousands of people around the world around corporate innovation. So he is a keynote at this event. So what I'm saying is, personally, I'm thrilled that, in a sense, we're able to mobilize these key stakeholders. And what I want to make sure, and I appreciate the opportunity to come on today, I want to make sure Sacramento understands this is an event that should be relevant nationally, should be very relevant statewide, but is also maybe the hidden byproduct, Sacramento's opportunity to rise up.
Agreed.
And play a role in what is a larger sort of technology ecosystem. And so this is our moment. This is the time to sort of step up. And I think the value proposition is extraordinary. If you are a startup company and you're looking for access to angels, venture capital firms, corporate venture groups, even family offices mm-hmm. who are actively investing, they will all be there.
Yeah.
If you are an investor, it's efficient access to a lot of interesting entrepreneurs, not just from Sacramento. There's a number of companies that are coming from the Bay Area, from Southern California, from Utah, literally from the Western United States. So this should be, if we end up achieving our objective, it should be about 50% from the sort of the greater Sacramento area, 50% from the Western United States, which is a different type of conference or summit. You know, somewhere around 1,500 people we're anticipating. Yeah. So it's going to be relatively large scale.
Yeah, for sure. And I've been there in the past. I've tried to support as much as I can. I know I've been there doing interviews and things like that. And it is a great place to be. I'm really looking forward to it. Again, it's July 13th, right?
June 19th.
Wow. June 19th, yep. Folks. Sorry about that. Brian, can you edit that, please? Just kidding. Well, jumping back to how maybe we started the conversation about my mission statement around my family, friends, and community, I feel like we've talked about the community a little bit. When I say friends, as part of my mission statement, I've always thought of my friends as my business partners and my teammates, and as I want to help create opportunity for them as they succeed, you know, I succeed as well. So maybe we can jump into that world a little bit, thinking about these people that we invest into, our teammates, but you being in venture capital, me being an angel investor. Let's talk about these investees. I mean, what do you look for in deciding who's a good fit for Impact and who's not a good fit? Who's no way?
Sure. So as you may be familiar, in the venture capital industry, you oftentimes establish an investment thesis by stage, by industry sector, by geography, and then you try and figure out ways you're going to add value beyond capital. So from a stage standpoint, we invest in seed stage companies, right? They don't have to have the product completed. They don't have to have revenues really, really early in the process, because that's where we feel like we can have the most positive influence. Mentoring is a sounding board. So from a stage standpoint, we're a seed stage investor. Mm-hmm. From a sector standpoint, we think artificial intelligence intelligence is now being applied to almost every industry sector. So if you look back 10, 15, 20 years ago, you know, when the internet and e-commerce was sort of being introduced and launched, you sort of thought, oh, well, this is one industry segment that we should pay attention to. And now if you look at the internet and e-commerce and mobile transactions, it impacts every market sector. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how we're thinking about artificial intelligence. So it's artificial intelligence applied to cybersecurity. It's artificial intelligence applied to robotics, to drones. So if there's an entrepreneur that's thinking about a company and they're embracing artificial intelligence from an industry sector, we're particularly interested.
You know, it's interesting because I have a little bit different thesis because I think maybe angel investors generally have a different thesis. I think angel investors, by and large, really want to help somebody invest into somebody that they can sort of look them in the eye at the end of the day and be proud that they're helping one of these up-and-comers. So for me, I'm really focused relentlessly on our hometown in Sacramento, and I am not really looking by industry sector as much, although I get turned on by cool products as much as anybody else. I really look at entrepreneurs themselves, the leadership team, the founding team, and the CEO specifically. So thinking about that, you're talking about these sectors and these technologies and so on. But how important is the entrepreneur? I have to think that it ranks above the technology.
In the real estate world, it's location, location, location. In the seed stage investment world, it's team, team, team.
Okay.
Right. But let me make one comment on geography, because where angel investors have had the most success and where they seem to be concentrated is investing in companies where they really know the team, and it's oftentimes in their own geography. Mm-hmm. So you have angel investors across the country that are passionate about building businesses in that geography. And so that's a big part of their thesis. Those are deals that they have access to. They feel like they can add value. Oftentimes they'll ride on the board of directors or in the early stages of the company. So from a geography standpoint, most angels across the country invest close to home.
Yeah.
And they're a big part of the capital food chain because they fund the deal at the local level, and then maybe a venture capital comes in and leads the first, you know, is the lead investor for the Series A. Maybe a corporate venture group is the lead investor or participates in the Series B, and then the company, you know, keeps growing. But to circle back to the second part of your comment, you know, looking at the entrepreneurial community and sort of which entrepreneurs sort of make sense to invest in and which don't. Those that are active listeners seem to be more enthusiastic about learning and more interested in identifying their blind spots.
Uh-huh. More so coachable in some way.
More coachable. I think that's a big part of it. I think that entrepreneurs that have proprietary insight to a major market problem, mm-hmm. They were at Intel, and Intel wasn't addressing a particular opportunity, and so they decided to leave Intel and go, you know, focus just on what they saw as a big problem that needed to be addressed in the market. So unique insight into a problem, I think is something that we look for in entrepreneurs. Certainly fire in the belly. What level of initiative? Why is it important that this company is built? And sometimes you sense that they had a personal experience or that they're so hungry to have a positive impact on the world, to create value, all of those things, personal experience, value creation, unique insight. Once you start to align up those elements of an entrepreneur's story, you start to recognize, wait a minute, this is someone that, you know, I could really work with. I think the other thing is, oftentimes I'm finding that there has to be some level of a chemistry quotient, right? Hmm. You're talking about a seed stage investor that's going to build their company, and if successful, it's going to probably take 6, 8, 10 years to get to an exit. You're going to be involved with this company for a long time.
Right.
It's a long-term relationship. You have to be enthusiastic about empowering that entrepreneur, about extending your own credibility on behalf of that entrepreneur. The level of integrity of that entrepreneur has to be at the highest level, because you're going to start making introductions to some of your closest contacts.
You become that entrepreneur's potentially their biggest advocate or one of their biggest advocates. Interesting. So one of the things that I look for, you know, we're sitting up here inside Mark Tank, and I actually have we do an event. We've done our first one. It's called Mark Tank, where we bring in some of my co-investor friends and some people who are pitching ideas. But the angel investor, he or she gets to make a decision alone. And I'm thinking about something like with impact, making that decision, developing that chemistry. You have Do you have a team that helps decide on that chemistry?
Yeah, so we have three general partners. Two are located in the Bay Area, headquartered out of our Burlingame office, and then I'm here, of course. We have two people on the operations team, one involved in investor relations and the other really driving sort of all aspects of deal flow and investment opportunities, investment memos, due diligence, those types of things. And then we have 10 venture partners. These are part-time advisors for us that are experts in various industries. Some that you and I have know in common. People like John Finnegan, who's been in the ag tech space for 20 years, right? If there's an ag tech investment that we're looking at, we're not going to make that investment unless John says, hey, I'm really excited about this. There's other people on our team that have media tech experience or government technology experience. So depending on the industry sector, we always have a venture partner to bring in and provides us with a due diligence source prior to investment, but also provides us with the ability to add value post-investment. So right. that small army of people, in addition to the broad professional networks that we have, provides us with a valuable team to lean on during due diligence and then post-investment value.
One of the things I look for, so we meet these people that come, let's say, out of UC Davis with a great idea. Maybe they have fire in their belly at some level, or they have a really proprietary product, maybe IP associated with it that makes it hard to beat in some ways. But one of the things that, and I wonder at your level, at the seed stage level, how much you look at revenue. Because one of the things I look at is, can this entrepreneur move molecules? Do they have the leadership presence to rally a team, to rally customers, to rally an industry, if you will? Because a lot of people that have great ideas and maybe even this proprietary knowledge, they don't possess that skill or that talent to really rally people. And I'm wondering, when you run into that, how do you think of that? I know you run into people with great ideas, with passion, but they're not that good at communicators. They're really going to have a difficult time rallying a sales force or rallying a group of investors to come on board. How do you approach that? Do you try to help put them together with somebody that is like that? I'm just kind of picturing, I see that a lot.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. Sometimes there's people that are extremely deep on the technical side and they really understand the product that needs to be created, but they don't have the sales skills to help support their fundraising efforts, their recruiting efforts, to close those initial pilot projects with customers. So I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, there's an element to being a successful entrepreneur in the early stages before the company is built, before the product is built, before the idea is even mature. You have to be able to articulate it and get people excited about your excitement, right? Because there's nothing there yet. And so you have to, as they say, sort of create the illusion of success and then quickly build reality behind it, right? You know, how fast can you move to show people the vision that you've got for building that company? So sales skills, presentation skills are absolutely critical. In fact, just a quick aside, my son and I run an entrepreneurs club for middle school students. We ran it at Sacramento Country Day School and at the Robertson Community Center in Del Paso Heights this year. And what we found was that after taking these students through 10 modules of finance, fundraising, sales, marketing, all this stuff, the byproduct was having them actually present each week, because they were taking half-baked ideas on drone technology or cybersecurity or AI. They were embracing some really interesting ideas and technologies, and that was great. And they were developing the decks for the year-end showcase and the pitch day. But the byproduct that as we look back on the experience was each week they were having to present sort of on the market or how they were going to sell or what their business model was, and those presentations.
These
skills,
are high school children, high school kids,
middle school and high school,
and they have to get up in front of their peers and present. And there's a number of adults in the audience.
So 10 weeks of presenting in front of their peers, and then the year-end event included about 100 people, and so that was teachers, students, grandparents, siblings, all that kind of stuff. A year-end kind of showcase event, which was quite a lot of fun. But it takes a lot of guts to get up after working on a company for just 10 weeks and present. And they were fearless.
They were fearless. That's interesting you say that, because you see this as well. We see people that are nervous before they get up and make a pitch, especially when you're making your first few pitches. It can be nerve-wracking. Now I'm envisioning a child, a kid, and it's being so brand new, they've just created it in the last 10 weeks,
yeah.
and then they have to get up in front of somebody and be the authority speaker on the product. That seems intimidating.
The power, I think, is in the dress rehearsals. If you have 10 weeks of dress rehearsal where you feel like you're fine-tuning your idea and you're getting critical and candid feedback from people who you know are working to empower you and guide you, I think your level of confidence going in to the year-end event is a bit of a celebration. So I don't mean to say that they weren't nervous, but it's pretty darn impressive to see a 12, 13-year-old boy or girl stand up on stage in front of 100 people and talk about things like single-person drones flying from Sacramento to San Francisco and how that could be more cost-effective and time-efficient than a helicopter. You know, those kinds of things. I mean, there were just some really interesting ideas. And I bring it up because when you talk about sales skills and presentation skills and the ability to articulate ideas that are in your head, advance them to a prototype stage, advance them to presenting them as a company, it's a powerful set of skills. Yeah. And you give people the opportunity to kind of fine-tune those over multiple weeks, and suddenly they get good at it. And yeah. So that was a lot of fun to see.
Well, thinking about, so for the entrepreneurs out there that are maybe more advanced, they're looking to raise money. How is the industry change in your mind? I mean, we talk about revenue. I look for companies, even though I've invested into a few that were idea stage and had a couple of good exits. But thinking to myself, I'm looking for people who have a pathway to profitability. That's sure. sort of where I'm at in my sure. thesis. And you being at the seed stage, how important is revenue and profitability? Is that something you're taking into consideration? I mean, today's revenue and today's profitability?
The existing revenue and the existing profitability are irrelevant from the standpoint of the stage that we're investing at. The pathway to revenue is critical. The pathway to profitability. How capital efficient is this business? If we invest today, how much more capital do you need to get to profitability? Those are critical questions that we analyze at a very, very deep level. Do they have to have that today? No, they don't. But do we have to have clear visibility to revenues in the future? Absolutely. What are the sales channels? How are you getting to these customers? You know, who is your customer? I mean, it's amazing. You just ask the question to an entrepreneur, who is your customer and how are you getting to them? Sometimes they struggle a little bit. That's a fundamental question, you know, a couple of questions in the early stages, right? Yeah. And if you haven't thought that through and you don't understand sort of the competitive landscape or how much capital it's going to take to get to cash flow positive, at least an estimate,
yes.
Then you haven't done some of the basic homework to enable a robust conversation with an institutional investor.
For sure. And it's interesting, yeah. Especially these earlier stage companies, there is typically, maybe it's 100% of the time, there's a pivot in those estimates, right? There's a pivot in who we're going to market with, who's going to actually buy the product, where we're actually going to make our money. You know, these assumptions, they're only so good.
Right.
Yeah.
I think some of these entrepreneurs feel like, why would I go through the exercise of putting together a 3 or 5 year forecast when it's all just a complete guess? I think from our perspective, it's not about the numbers being accurate in sort of year five. Are those the exact revenues? That's not what we're looking to do. We're looking to understand the assumptions and the sophistication of how you thought through year one, year two, year three, all the way through. And how big could this business get? If you're wildly successful, is this a business that has $10 million in revenue in year five? Or might you have $100 million and your underlying assumptions all make sense? We have to work together with the entrepreneurial teams that we invest in to go prove those underlying assumptions, but we want to at least see that you've done the homework and thought it through. And our view at the end of the day is that the entrepreneur's best guess at the financial forecast for a business is better than anybody else's in the world. So let's look at that best guess along with the underlying assumptions. And oftentimes the smart ones have benchmarked another successful company. So they've said, here's our model company. Mm-hmm. Here's how fast they grew. And here's what we know about them. And look, we're modeling our company right after that. I mean, we're building our venture fund after venture funds that we've seen that now have $1 billion under management, right? Yeah. We've modeled out how can we grow to that? What would we have to do? How many companies would we have to invest in? At what size? What are our ownership percentages? And we have some fundamental assumptions that we're going to test. We have to go prove it, and we have to make progress year after year, but at least we've put together the model of what our target is.
I'm going to bend the conversation a little bit. You brought up your son, Jackson. You and I are both fathers. Father's Day is not long away. It's a few weeks in front of us. But the one thing that has always inspired me, beyond the other things we've been talking about you, Jack, though, is the way you've approached your role as a dad, your role as a leader of a family, and you've taken this strategic approach to your family and to building the best family possible. I feel like I've tried to do that too in my own way, but I think you and I are sort of kindred spirits on that. We really, I think everybody wants to build a great family, but how do you be more thoughtful about it? Give us your, what do you do differently? I know you have your strategic plan for life and a mission statement, I believe, associated with your family. I mean, give us some perspective from somebody who looks at building a family from a business standpoint.
Well, I mean, I'd start just by saying I get a tremendous amount of support from my wife with ideas, with insight, with sometimes sharp perspective that I don't necessarily like to hear, highlighting
blind spots. You get that too,
huh?
Yeah. Okay, yeah, I do too.
I feel like it's a partnership with her in creating the family that we wanted to. But I think it was 10 years ago, it was more like 15 years ago, we put together kind of the beginnings of a business plan for life that turned into this sort of strategic plan for life. And the idea was that as the world throws things at you, most people seem to be responding and reacting to just what the world is throwing at them, and they're not necessarily proactively living life. And so we started to identify sort of what we wanted to hopefully make happen in our lives, and how could we focus our energy and enthusiasm around those areas. And so we came up with, like, you know, just like a business, we came up with core values of, mm-hmm. you know, empowering people and focus on family and making bold moves. We came up with this sort of Crawford Constitution, if you will, mm-hmm. that had these elements of things that we wanted to focus on. And then I started to think about how I was investing my own time. And I found that, you know, investing a certain amount of time in faith and a certain amount of time in fitness and finance and family and then fun. You know, there were these five sort of Fs that I was, mm-hmm. and I just kind of went through the process of identifying bold moves that I could make in each of those areas. And as you start to think about it in that way, core values, and then how are you really spending your time, and bold moves that you could make in those areas that are most important to you, if this identity map started to reveal itself of who I was going to be when I grow up, right? Mm-hmm. And what are the areas that I really wanted to focus my time on? And I think so many times people have a busy season that turns into a busy year that turns into just a busy life where they get distracted from the things that are really important to them. And I find that having a strategic plan for life brings a recurring moment of clarity mm-hmm. that enhances my perspective on life and what's really important, and encourages me to spend time and brain power in those areas so that I feel like I'm living the life that I hoped I would, and time isn't going by where I sort of fell asleep or I was unconscious for a year and got away from those things that were truly important to me. So just as I've heard the example that I really like, just as you have a flight plan for a plane that goes from one destination to another, it doesn't stay exactly on sort of that straight line path to that destination, but it reaches that destination most days, right? Mm-hmm. You know, unless there's something crazy that happens.
Interesting.
Most times it hits that destination. So you're constantly nudging back toward the flight plan. And I kind of like that analogy, because in life, what I find is, in interacting with some people that have gone through some tremendously challenging times, that their perspective is changed once they endure a tragedy.
I would agree.
Something really bad happened to my health or my business or my family or, you know, a close friend. And I've certainly had some close friends that have just had to endure some extremely challenging situations. And what I found is that they have enlightened perspective because of that tragedy. I wonder if a proactive way of thinking about this allows us to have that perspective without the tragedy. And if I can stay focused on sort of the things that are really important to me today, and this week and this month, maybe I can do it for a lifetime. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the thesis, this proactive approach to living life in line with the things that I think are most important, that my wife thinks are most important, that my kids think are most important. So now this strategic plan for life and little 100-day plans have been adopted all the way down to the level of my, you know, 11-year-old daughter, who's thinking about what's really important to her. And she's wow. she's mirroring some of the things that I've done. And it's fun to see.
I love it. I mean, I haven't been quite as... I guess I won't say I haven't been as thoughtful. I haven't been as strategic in terms of using like a business type strategy for our family. And our family's a little bit older. Right? My kids are 31 and 33. I have three grandchildren. And thinking about growing up, it was a lot about core values. We didn't talk about specifically our top five core values or anything like that. But we have an extremely close family. We have an extremely close group of people with my kids and my wife and stuff like that. So that was something that somehow I think we were pretty good at. And I think each of us have had our own little ups and downs and tragedies in our life. But I think as an older guy, now with grandkids, I really stepped back and tried to take it in perspective. What can I do to help sort of, I don't know, shape, put the environment forward for more unity and maybe a longer vision. We begin to create this 100-year plan as our family. And it's not very detailed because we're busy. I mean, my daughter's a successful realtor. My son's got his business. And, you know, my wife and I are going 100 different directions. So it's interesting to think about like the communication that it takes to keep it tied together, even as the family ages. I've got to think that having that communication and those written plans at these earlier years is going to pay off dividends when you get to be my age and when you start having the next generation pop up.
I hope so. I'll tell you one thing that's happening now that I think is interesting is I get to see the ideas from my kids' heads pour into colored stickies that end up on the wall of my home office, right? And so when you have kind of a family dream board, you don't know everything that your 11-year-old daughter is thinking, right? But then you start seeing things that she puts up on the wall, and they start to reveal themselves. And I think we're developing skills, we're developing alignment, and maybe one element that's interesting is we're developing points of leverage, meaning that if I can look at something that's on my dream board and something similar happens to be on my wife's and, oh, there's something on my daughter's, maybe we can execute on one project together or one trip together or one activity together that actually accomplishes three or four of the dreams or objectives or priorities of people in my family. So what I'm finding is there's opportunities for alignment, there's opportunities for insight, and there's opportunities for leverage. Mm-hmm. And that's when it gets fun, because if you run an entrepreneurs club with your kid at school and people say you're crazy, that's a lot of time that you're investing in the school, I say back to them, do you know how much time I got to spend with my son over the last 12 weeks? Do you know how much I contributed to the school that he goes to? Do you know how much I contributed with my son to the students in Del Paso Heights, a pretty challenged mm-hmm. area that don't have access to this type of academic programs? Do you know how much I learned personally about kids and how they're thinking about technology that has elevated my investing IQ as a venture capitalist? I got incredible leverage off of that experience. So yes, it was a significant amount of time, but it was this concept of leverage where I feel like it's a life hack. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Getting more out of life with each hour invested.
Well, you've inspired me, because that's kind of how you continue to live your life, is sort of like hacking these systems, being a little more tactical, a little more strategic in advancing your mission in life. And so just thinking about, I'm going to challenge you a little bit on this. You know, it's Father's Day coming up, and you're the leader in many ways of your family, even though, you know, everybody leads in a family. Everybody's got influence. But I think as a dad, especially as the main breadwinner of a family, thinking about the other entrepreneurs out there, it doesn't have to be a dad, it could be a mom. But people talk about this life balance concept. How do you keep life balance and that kind of stuff? And when I hear entrepreneurs talking about that issue and about how they've got to carve out this different time for their families and still maintain their work balance, and yet they're really underwater from in a financial position, or maybe they're underwater and behind in many areas of their life that they have goals in. But specifically when you're growing a business, and you might go, a lot of these businesses go out of business because people didn't do enough of the right stuff. They might have the right stuff in terms of heart and core values and, you know, a good strategic plan for life. But you know, the business is sinking, and to be able to take and put the lion's share of your energy into the business to keep it alive, sometimes you have to like do that for years on, upon years in order to survive as a company, to you know, to make sure your employees aren't left without a job, to make sure your investors aren't you know, out of their money, and the sort of the life balance piece needs to get put, and this is my opinion, needs to get put out off to the side for a second, so you can prioritize on making sure that you don't lose this thing that you've began. Mm-hmm. I don't know, thoughts on that. How do you, you know, there's people listening that are sitting here going, well, sounds good, Mark. You'd have a 100-year plan. Sounds good, Jack. You got this cool little thing. You guys are successful guys. You guys have already built something that has, you know, you have a decent living here. But what about the rest of us that are, I've started something and I'm dying over here.
Yeah. I think one thought that comes to mind, Mark, is basically a focus. And that's, you know, how focused can you be at the office? Are you really bringing your A game if you're distracted by the disruption in your relationship with your wife? Or if you are not paying attention to your health, how much energy are you really bringing? If you feel like you're neglecting your kids, how much enthusiasm and creativity are you really bringing? Now, the opposite of that is, what if you feel like that stuff's buttoned up and you're doing a pretty good job? How much energy, enthusiasm, creativity are you bringing to your professional efforts every day? I would argue that if you can proactively live your life in a way that addresses your health, that addresses your faith, that addresses your marriage, that addresses your kids, those things are sort of tracking in such a positive direction that the level of energy, enthusiasm, joy, and happiness that you bring to your coworkers and to your business objectives is elevated to a new level. If, on the other hand, you just navigated through a couple of heart attacks because you were you know, your health wasn't good. If your marriage is beyond repair and now you're navigating through the separation of you know, sort of your marriage, and if your kids don't like you because you're not spending a lot of time with them, I think you're probably going to be a bit distracted at the office. And so why are we working so hard if we're not going to pay attention to kind of the fruits of that labor, which is maximizing the amount of time with your family? And so I think there are ways to spend time with your family and sharpen your professional skills. I think there are ways to, I certainly learned a lot from my wife over the years. There are ways to interact with your life partner to sort of, you know, identify opportunity areas. But I don't think, I think it's not just about life balance in my mind. I think this is more about proactive living, staying awake, staying focused, recognizing this is my moment of the day to achieve something professionally. And guess what? I'm going to work as hard as I can for the next 3 or 4 hours on this, and then I'm going to take a break and go shoot baskets with my daughter. And then I'm going to come back in, and when everybody's asleep, I might put in a few more hours. So I think it's about focus, time management, and maybe keeping an enlightened perspective on what's really important and why are we doing what we're doing. I remember one quick comment. I remember reading something about blue zones, this idea of sort of the people who are living the longest, who are the most fulfilled in the world, and sort of they were breaking it up by geography, and they went and looked at patterns of these people, and the patterns that they saw were all of them really focused on sort of health and nutrition. Those were two elements. The other two elements were they identified their purpose in life early, and they expanded their social connections. And I thought, wow, that's pretty profound. Mm. If I can focus on those four areas of life, you know, health and physical fitness and nutrition, just making sure I'm eating well and really zeroing on sort of life's purpose and then broadening social connections on a regular basis, if I can focus on those four areas, maybe I'll end up living a more fulfilled life. Yeah. Maybe I'll end up empowering more people to achieve their objectives personally, professionally, with their families. And so anyway, it's. I thought that was an interesting sort of benchmark.
Yes, very insightful. And I want to thank you again as we sort of wrap up. Thanks for what you've done for me personally. Thanks for what you do for this community that we both love. And I think for the entrepreneurs that, you know, I think today was really educational. I think that's how you sort of live your life, is helping that next person in line. So I want to thank you for that. And I respect that with very, very much, Jack.
Oh, I always learn a lot from you, Mark, and I really appreciate the opportunity to come on the show today.
You bet. Thank you.